In the late 1860s, the government deployed commissioners to carry out an investigation into the employment of children, young persons, and women in agriculture. And their reports revealed details of exploitation, cruelty, poverty, and distress that many members of the public had never associated with the countryside. But details which bear out Mrs. Burrows' account of her childhood. Let me give you just a few instances of the sort of things that were reported. So the commissioners spoke of families, quote, worse lodged than cattle and worse cared for. That was in Cambridgeshire. They told of boys as young as six in Norfolk and Suffolk, in Essex, Sussex and Gloucester, being employed as bird scarers, quote, as soon as they are strong enough or can shout. Some of you who've read Jude the Obscure will remember that Jude began as a bird scarer too in Hardy's novel. There were accounts of children of the age of eight put to ploughing in Dorset or becoming wagoner's mates in Hampshire before they were 10. And furthermore, these children were often expected to work up to 14 or even 16 hours in the day. Widespread illiteracy was recorded, up to 50% amongst adult agricultural workers, according to one commissioner. And the case is cited of a Gloucestershire farmer who threatened to discharge a 16-year-old if he attended night school because he, the farmer, claimed the boy's services from 5 in the morning till 9 at night. But the reports raised particular alarm over the alleged moral corruption associated with the mixed gangs of labourers found especially in the eastern counties, and also associated with working conditions in the glove and lace-making districts of Oxfordshire and the straw platters of Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire. In contrast, very interestingly in contrast, to all these bleak findings, however, the report on North Northumberland recorded conditions in which the labourers, usually called hinds, live upon the farms, are hired by the year, and paid chiefly in kind from the produce of the farm, the keep of a cow being invariably a part, and a very valuable part, of their remuneration. These arrangements ensured payment all the year round, which was a huge problem in many other parts of the country, the lack of that kind of assurance. It also, of course, secured a reliable supply of food and milk. In this area, young children were not employed in field work, but attended school, and the wives of the hinds ran the household. The emphasis on education in this region is attributed to the influence of the example from the nearby Scottish lowlands, where education was highly prioritised. And the reviewer of the government reports in Fraser's Magazine maintains that as a result, what he calls the high-spirited and well-educated men of the North have compelled farmers to accept that they will no longer tolerate the wretched living conditions characteristic of so much of the South, where, in the reviewer's words, there seem no signs of progress. The ploughman now appears to be just the same as he was a century ago when Gibbon, in his contemptuous pity, classed him along with his fellow labourer, the ox. So quite a striking sort of north-south contrast being highlighted there. And that same contrast actually reappears elsewhere. It's strikingly illustrated in Henry Ryder Haggard's monumental two-volume study, Rural England. Now, Haggard is better known probably as the author of novels like King Solomon's Mines, She and Alan Quatermain, but he also, as I say, wrote this very large work called Rural England, because he was a farmer with land at Ditchingham in Norfolk. And at the beginning, very beginning of the 20th century, over the course of 1901, 1902, Haggard had travelled through 27 English counties and also the Channel Islands to make what he described as an investigation of the conditions of the rural England of our day. To his own considerable surprise, some of the worst conditions he encountered were at a farm near Waltham in Essex. This is what he wrote. Let the reader realise the position. The men, 20 or perhaps less of them in winter, within 30 miles of London, existed, and I presume still exist, at all seasons of the year, in a fashion that the lowest Kaffirs would refuse. Their sleeping place, a crowded shed. Their bedding, sacks. Their shelter by day, a tree. Their food, such as unskilled hands can cook in an iron pot. Their female society, none. Their recreation, the beer house, whereas their master told me they spend the most of their good wages. Their refuge in sickness, the public infirmary, to which, when I was at the place, one of them had just been taken. Now remember, this is the beginning of the 20th century now. It's not the dim and distant past. In contrast with this, towards the end of his travels, Haggard gives his judgment that despite problems with rural depopulation and despite the impact of industry in the region, and I quote, better general farming is to be found in Yorkshire than in any other part of England I have visited, chiefly because neither the owners nor the occupiers of land in that county are so poor as is the case elsewhere. Ironically, it is the proximity of the rural areas in Yorkshire to industrial cities and towns, places which Haggard himself absolutely abhorred. He regarded the cities as abhorrent not only for their ugliness, but because of his belief in the corrosive effect of urban life on not only the physical, but the moral fibre of the people who live there. But it was that proximity which was one of the main reasons why wages tended to be higher and poverty was less of an issue. This is a point complemented in a slightly different way and perhaps looking in a slightly different area by some recent research undertaken by S.A. Kuntz on the mechanisation of agriculture in the northeast between 1850 and 1914. And Kuntz argues that by 1850, the relatively heavy rural population in the south and the deep-seated hostility of that population towards machinery contributed to long-term unemployment, low wages, and prolonged social tension. But, in contrast, he says, northeastern agricultural wages were up to twice those in the worst-paid southern counties due to the ever-growing competition from mines and industry for a historically much lighter population, and systematic social conflict was entirely absent. So in various ways, there's a significant difference, both in terms of relative wealth, if you want, or financial security, and also in terms of social tensions. Now, in the talk so far, I've concentrated really on contrasting representations and realities of work in the countryside. But I want to move to another subject that was highly controversial, and that was rural housing. Again, I imagined that if people were asked what they associate with the words countryside or country life, lots would mention cottages, something you think of as being characteristically of the country. And by cottages, I guess they might, in some measure, have images like these in mind. There are several of them for you to look at. There's one, this type of a cottage. Here's a second. And one more. These are all works by Helen Allingham. Her work continues to be widely reproduced, and I think more generally, often provides the colours, the tones, even some of the details that are characteristic of many commercially produced rural-themed products of one kind and another. Helen Allingham's cottage scenes, as in the examples you've just been looking at, repeatedly foreground women, young girls or children, thereby of course giving them very highly gendered associations. Furthermore, these figures, simple but clean clothes, their engagement in domestically related activities, or in the case of the children, in play, and their location alongside sunlit cottages, which often look picturesquely ramshackle, but not dilapidated or dirty, and are frequently covered with roses in bloom and other flowers, all combine to project a very idealised image of English cottage life. It is, of course, a very partial view, and one with particular appeal to urban audiences, attracted by a vague belief, or perhaps more accurately, a vague desire to believe, in the prelapsarian qualities of the rural good life. There is, however, a real irony in these associations, because across the 19th century, the condition of country cottages was repeatedly used as a kind of yardstick or measure to inform the moral and social judgments of critics made both against negligent landlords and concerning the lives of the cottagers themselves, the people who actually lived there. We find an interesting alternative view in a poem by the Rotherham-born poet Ebenezer Elliott. Here he gives a rather alternative version of rose-clad cottages, British rural cottages in 1842. The scentless rose trained by the poor may sometimes grace the peasant's door, but when will comfort enter there? Beauty without hides death within, like flowers upon the shroud of sin. For e'en the poor man's marriage joys, his wife, his sad-lipped girls and boys, in mercy or in mockery given, but brighten when their hour of heaven, a life of ghastly toil and care. His pay is pain, his hope despair, although the cottage rose is fair. Out of his weekly pittance small, 3 crowns for children, wife and all, poor British slave, how can he save a pittance for his evening's clothes? No roses deck the workhouse grave. Where is the aged pauper's rose? Very different perspective. And more specific comments are found elsewhere. Over an 18-month period between 1849 and 1851, the Morning Chronicle newspaper ran an unprecedented investigative survey into the lives of the poor in manufacturing, metropolitan and rural districts of the country. This was the heading they used. And the methodology that the itinerant reporters employed attempted to capture both the typical and the untypical features of the particular areas in the social context of the whole community. And they did this by combining narrative description with information taken from key witnesses who were usually long-standing local residents. The survey was launched in the aftermath of public anxieties caused first by the recent Chartist agitation in the late 1840s, agitation which sought political and social reform, but also by the cholera epidemic of 1848-49, which took a vast number of lives. And it appeals to a curious combination of middle-class readers' preoccupations. First, a kind of vicarious fascination with the alien conditions of the lives of the poor. Also, the fear of the possible consequences that those conditions might lead to. And also to the sense of moral outrage provoked by their very existence. So, for example, the reporter covering Buckinghamshire, Berkshire, Wiltshire and Oxfordshire writes, If the reader will accompany me, I shall lead him into a cabin constituting the abode of some of his contemporaries and fellow subjects. So you're invited to kind of take a walk on the wild side with the reporter from the Morning Chronicle. And I want just to try to suggest how the account is shaped by selecting a few sentences from what follows. So we get this. The approach to the cabin is by a narrow road, flanked on either side by mouldering banks, crowned with decaying hedgerows. The air is close and stifling, the spot seeming to have been designed for engendering malaria of the most pestilential description. The cabin is rude and uncouth, and it has less the appearance of having been built than of having been suddenly thrown up out of the ground. The length is not above 15 feet, its width between 10 and 12. There are but two rooms in the house, one below and the other above, and yet we counted 9 in the family. And the report includes many details of the squalid and damp interior, of the family's ragged clothes and their lack of food, furnishings and privacy. The writer also is most insistent that this picture is not overdrawn, but genuinely represents, I quote, the condition of a very great number of Englishmen, not in the backwoods of a remote settlement, but in the heart of Anglo-Saxon civilization in the year of grace, 1849. Again and again in the reports, dirt and disease, malnutrition and overcrowding, ignorance, immorality, incest and drunkenness are highlighted as characteristic of much cottage life. And these are recurrent claims in newspaper articles, in official reports, and even in fictional accounts of the period. Far from being a focus for pastoral idealism, impoverished cottage life gave substance to some of the Victorians' deepest anxieties and doubts. The Morning Chronicle's emphasis on the fact that the problems are found at the heart of Anglo-Saxon civilization and not in some untamed part of the world, and the deliberate use of that phrase, the year of grace 1849, reminding readers of their Christian heritage, resonate with dismay and concern that such places could exist at all in England. Cottage life not only highlighted class differences, which were not perhaps questioned all that closely in themselves, but it showed how, in some circumstances, these differences had become so extreme that the poorest had ceased even to be describable as members of the same race as their middle-class observers. There are recurrent comparisons of the poor to animals, to serfs, to slaves, and to various supposedly uncivilized ethnic groups. The literature of the period provides compelling evidence of this. So, for example, Karen Sayer cites an article in the Saturday Review of the 13th of February 1869, which notes how in Northumberland, where housing was good and wages were better, the conduct of the peasant women is substantially virtuous and correct. The women talk the language of their own caste, which is not that of the drawing rooms, but they expiate their precocious slips from virtue by irreproachable fidelity as wives and mothers. Good for them. Whereas in East Anglia, the women and girls act and speak like the harlot caste of a savage race. Clearly a place to avoid. And as Karen Sayer comments on this, here the homes and language of the poor are not just used to signify their moral condition, they're also used as a sign of difference in the experience of the two classes. The cottage is used as a marker for, a sign of, the lamentable gap between rich and poor, while the language of the poor and other savage races is placed in direct contrast to that of the drawing room. In other words, the languages and homes of the official observers. So there's a kind of moral and class judgment being made in the very way in which this is reported. So how then, we might well wonder, do we get from the position where the country cottage appeared to be the site of so many deep-seated problems to the gentle lyricism of Helen Allingham's paintings that I showed you earlier? And I don't think there's actually a simple answer to that question. However, gradually, living conditions did improve. Sanitary reforms, improvements to water supplies, clearance of the worst properties, and pressures on landlords all played their part. But so too did education, social aspiration, and social mobility. In a chapter called Change in the Village, which comes at the end of Larkrise to Candleford, Flora Thompson records how some of the Candleford Green residents were quick to exchange their cottages for one of the new villas, of which many were built in the late 19th century, if opportunity presented itself through a new job or because of better wages. And even though naturally the majority stayed put, living much as in the past, nevertheless, change was still catching up with them. And in George Sturt's book, also called Change in the Village, he records how in the closing years of the 19th century, not only were new villas built in the hamlet of Lower Bourne near Farnham in Surrey, after piped water had been laid on, but the houses of many of the old residents were taken over by affluent incomers who began the now familiar process of improving them by importing modern urban conveniences into their cottage homes and adopted cottage lives. These homes and lives would still have been different from what we see in Helen Allingham's work, but the newly arrived occupants were in search of what I guess we might call a particular quality of life. We probably might even use the word a lifestyle. A lifestyle which derived from an idea of the countryside and of country living, which is implicit in Allingham's paintings. And this brings me to the point with which I want to finish. It's a commonplace in many discussions that in spite of the early rush to urbanisation in England, English identity continues to be thought of as rooted in the countryside, rather as William Howitt projected it. England is the country and the country is England, Stanley Bulwer famously said in 1926. Nowhere else is landscape so freighted as legacy, wrote David Lowenthal in 1991. Nowhere else does the very term suggest not simply scenery and genre de vie, but quintessential national virtues. And writing in 2011, Roy Strong observed how in Victorian England, as revulsion against the urban squalor increased, the countryside was seen to embody the timeless essence of Old England, encapsulated in the ancient manor house with its attendant village and parish church, which was enshrined in literature and the new medium of photography. You think back again to the Herring painting. Not only poets like Tennyson and Browning, and novelists like Trollope and Hardy, but also a magazine like Country Life, which first appeared in 1897, believe it or not, helped to reinforce this perception. But as Strong reminds us, it was a very selective and often regionally specific perception too. This rural vision apotheosized the landscape of southern England, the old Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, Kent, Sussex, Wiltshire, Somerset, Hampshire, and Dorset, with their cathedral cities, market towns, and villages. It glossed over the inequalities of a rural society graduating downwards from squire to farmer to craftsman to labourer. It emphasised mutual obligation and respect and the time-honoured rustic virtues of honesty, decency, goodness, and Christian respect. This is the South Country, which gives the title to Hilaire Belloc's poem of that name, and also, of course, to Edward Thomas's prose work, The South Country, as well as providing the background to his great poem, Lob, as well as many others. It is the locus of Kipling's stories in Puck of Pook's Hill, and the scene of George Sturt's wheelwright's shop, and many more examples besides. Even as robust a northerner as J.B. Priestley appears to recognise how myth and literature colour the terms in which he himself responds to the southern landscape as he travels across the Cotswolds. One moved mysteriously through a world of wet gold. Nothing had boundaries or real continuity. Roads climbed and vanished into dripping space. The little valleys were as remote as Avalon. The villages arrived like news from another planet. We might have been journeying through the England of the poets, a country made out of men's visions. So here then is another rural England, one which privileges a particular region with associations extending back beyond recorded history, and which acquires new value from having escaped the full impact of urbanisation and industrialism, even if modernity is nevertheless encroaching upon it. One might add in passing that it is a version of rural England that has proved remarkably enduring, not least, as Roy Strong observes, because of the role of the media in promoting it through adaptations of period novels, even in popular programmes like Downton Abbey, which I know is allegedly set in the north, but doesn't really make any use of that notion at all. Programmes also like Midsummer Murders, the Miss Marple stories, come out of this same kind of tradition. But we need to remember the extent to which this South Country is a constructed and highly selective version of rural England, a version which derives from a preferred idea of the countryside and of country life and work, and which principally served a deep-seated need in an urban population that had not wholly lost sight of its receding origins. The importance of this version of rural England must not be underestimated, but nor should it occlude our awareness of those other, harsher, more challenging, and much more unstable rural Englands I spoke about earlier, which of course constituted reality for generations of people whose homes and employment and basic ability to survive were wholly dependent on the personal disposition and economic fortunes of their local landlords and farmers. Thank you for being a very attentive audience.